This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the Wheeler Center podcast. My name is Beverly Wang, and it's a kind of a special edition because in lieu of a live show at the Wheeler Center, we're recording this conversation, and we're recording it on the land of the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And as always, we pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and future, and any First Nations people who are listening. And it's a special theatrical episode, I guess. We have Benjamin Law, playwright, journalist, radio co-host of mine on Stop Everything, another podcast. His debut play is called Torch the Place with the Melbourne Theatre Company. It's playing to nearly sold out shows in this debut run, and a big congratulations. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thanks, Beverly. It's good to be here.
It's nice to see you again. And from Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, we have Nguyen Duc Duy. He's the translator who has worked very closely with the director of Saigon, which is part of the Asia Topa program. The director, Carolyn Gila Nguyen, unfortunately couldn't travel from France to Melbourne for the show, but we'll be hearing from her shortly. And helping us today with this recording is Ellen Embling, who will be interpreting for Zui. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks, hello. Beverly.
Hello. Shall we kick off with a message from Caroline, who can't be here today?
Bonjour, voilà, je suis désolée de ne pas pouvoir être avec vous.
Hello, I'm sorry I can't be here. I would have loved to be in Australia, but it's a mighty journey from France. So I would be very interesting to see what's happening. What happened with the show in Australia? I trust that in Australia, and I know there are lots of Vietnamese, expatriate Vietnamese, that Viet Qs, as we call them in France, and also a lot of Vietnamese restaurants. My cast has sent me pictures of many Vietnamese restaurants in Melbourne. The show is a narrative about the community of the Vietnamese in overseas. And I was very happy to have Duy as a translator because he allowed me to connect with all the stories. Unfortunately, I do not speak Vietnamese fluently because my mother did not teach to me. And that was actually one of the problematics, one of the questions raised in the show, this isolation from a culture in order to allow for integration into a new society. The show has been going on since 2015. We have been working on it since 2015. It has been shown since 2017, and the stories have evolved. I hope you get a lot out of the show. Once again, I'm sorry I can't be there, and I wish you an excellent performance.
Thank you so much, Hélène. Zui, I'll start with you. As Ellen mentioned, Caroline doesn't speak any Vietnamese, so your role as a researcher and an interpreter was particularly important in putting this show together. Can you just start by talking us through the brief that Caroline presented you with and how you went about executing that?
En fait, Caroline, elle a quand même pu dire quelques petits mots vietnamiens. C'est ça ce qui m'a beaucoup étonné, parce que du coup, elle était la première cliente, on va dire, qui sait quelques petits mots vietnamiens. Alors qu'avant, j'ai travaillé avec d'autres personnes, d'autres Français, Belges, tout ça. Voilà, ils ne connaissent pas du tout la langue vietnamienne, mais ce n'est pas le cas pour Caroline, déjà ça. Après, c'est vrai que elle n'a pas la capacité de s'exprimer comme elle veut, parce qu'elle a toujours beaucoup de choses à dire, Caroline. Et du coup, c'est pour ça qu'elle avait besoin d'un traducteur pendant son voyage au Vietnam. Et du coup, elle a demandé un aide à l'Institut français, qui était en lien avec l'Université de pédagogie de Ho Chi Minh Ville. Et à ce moment-là, enfin à l'époque, j'étais encore étudiant dans cet établissement.
So, What Caroline, even though she speaks quite a few words of Vietnamese, which is unusual, because usually your customers, the customers of Zui, were more totally foreign to English. So it was a good thing that she spoke those words. But she has so much to say, which is the reason why she really needed an interpreter. So she approached in the French Institute, that Institut Français, that redirected her to Lille, where Zoe was still studying at the time, and then it had the opportunity to become the interpreter.
Et en fait, tout au début, l'Institut Français a appelé le département de français dans notre université. Mm-hmm. Ben, quand je dis notre université, c'est parce qu'on était deux. J'étais avec Thu, elle s'appelle Than Thu en vietnamien, Than Thu, voilà, un gros défi pour toi. Elle était en fait la doyenne, enfin, elle a confié la mission avec Caroline à Thu, et du coup, au début, je l'accompagne. Je l'accompagnais au début.
So, in the first instance, the French Institute contacted the university, and there were two people. So, the senior person was Tran Thu, and first Tran Thu took the job of the translation, but Zui was accompanying her.
Et plus tard après, Thu, elle a fini par monter sur scène et voilà, jouer un rôle dans le spectacle. Moi, je reste toujours dans l'ombre pour faire le métier de traducteur.
So, eventually, Thu became part of the show and was on stage, and Zui stayed in the shadow to keep his role as a translator.
Also, was there ever any conversation about you appearing in the play as a cast member?
Si, on voulait bien que tout le monde soit sur scène parce que c'est vrai que je pense, enfin ça c'est un avis personnel, je pense que chacun a ramené son truc, sa petite chose au spectacle et finalement, par exemple moi de mon côté, je pense que c'était des chansons que j'ai chantées pour eux pendant son séjour au Vietnam. Et en fait, on voulait que tout le monde soit sur scène, mais c'était pratiquement pas possible parce que du coup, il faut quand même quelqu'un qui traduit et qui aide les spectateurs à comprendre le spectacle.
That would have been the intention, as everyone had something to contribute. And the intention was to have everybody on stage. Zui actually contributed some songs that, you know, from Vietnam. But ultimately, for practicality, somebody had to be there to stay away and do the translation.
Et en fait, là, je pourrais me considérer comme, si je pourrais dire, un 12e comédien invisible. Parce que voilà, je suis toujours avec le spectacle en tant que surtitreur, donc celui qui lance, qui envoie des surtitres, voilà, pour aider aux spectateurs à comprendre le spectacle.
So, actually, if you look at the whole show with the 11 performers, it can be considered as a 12th performer because he's actually on the side watching the show and generating all the titles, subtitles, or subtitles, you know, during the show.
That's fascinating. So, during the show, it's not a static translation of the subtitles. You are... Talk us through what actually happens during the show, Zui.
Contrairement au cinéma, c'est ce qui fait... en fait, avec le cinéma, c'est pas pareil, parce que du coup, on fait la vidéo, on rajoute des surtitres, alors que là, dans le spectacle, il faut savoir que chaque comédien, il a son rythme, et puis chaque jour, il joue avec... Enfin, ça change. Il faut savoir que, voilà, une pièce de théâtre, ça, elle est là. Mais du coup, chaque jour, elle change. c'est comme un être humain. Enfin, on ne peut pas être... c'est la même pièce, mais du coup, ça change, ça évolue. Des fois, c'est meilleur, des fois, c'est pas aussi bien que d'habitude. Mais voilà, c'est ça aussi la beauté du spectacle. Donc, c'est-à-dire qu'on ne peut pas, on ne peut pas intégrer les surtitres dans le spectacle de façon automatique.
Okay, so that is that is the difference with movies, cinema, with film and cinema, is that in the process of the film, you do the video first and you can adapt the subtitles, no problem. In the terms of theater and this show in particular, actually we compare the show to a human being because it's never every day the same. Some days are better, some days are not as good. In any instance, he has to follow and reflect the evolution of the show every day as it goes. So Zoe has two categories of subtitles, the ones that are guaranteed to be there and the ones that might be there. So he has these two lists. And when he hears the performer, as soon as he starts, he has to prompt what is going to be said and send it then so that it's instant. So he has a special software for this purpose.
I might just go to Ben at this point. You're listening to what Zui's saying about the dynamism and the evolution of the production Night After Night. When it comes to Torch the Place, how has the show evolved from the writing process through to rehearsals and even on stage Night After Night? Where has it changed?
Maybe the real question is where hasn't it changed? Because from the first draft onwards, all the actors are completely involved. Then later on, we've got all of the designers and everything's really up for grabs. And the show that I've written is about the condition of compulsive hoarding. We're talking about big messes. And really, it's about how to make this mess come on stage and come to life. And with the actual story itself, I mean, like from, you know, theatre's so dynamic. I came from TV screenwriting just before I came into theatre. And with TV screenwriting, things are locked and then they're reshaped and then they're locked again, then they're reshaped. With theatre, it's so fluid. You know, someone can just have a throwaway joke that day and it's like, let's throw that in the performance tonight. That's genius. And it's not written in the script, of course, but let's try that tonight. Obviously, the previews are such a great opportunity for us to just experiment a little bit, not enough to throw the actors, the performers off. But hopefully by performing night, we've got exactly the text we want. But even then, you know, there's plenty of stuff that you can still throw in for spice and just for variation. So that's been quite... hilarious and joyous about doing this for the first time when it comes to me anyway.
When you're writing tortured by yourself,
yes.
You know, in your cave,
it's
writing
awful.
It all by yourself, and then you birth it, you bring it to the cast and the directors and they're making adjustments or suggesting things. What changes between just seeing the words and then hearing it performed? What do the actors, what's the feedback, the most important feedback you've gotten from actors about how you take that written word from the page to the stage?
Well, you know, one of the things that I feel like when people are reading my draft out for the first time is like, I don't have this experience as much nowadays because you and I are radio broadcasters. We have to listen to our voice all the time. But before we were broadcasters, I'm sure we had the experience everyone has, which is you're listening to your own voice and you're cringing. And that's the same sensation I have had with actors reading out my scripts at just a draft level. I'm like, please stop this. This is excruciating. Because you've read it in your own head. You've maybe read it out yourself during the writing process. But then to have it all on show, this play with all of its faults, and we all agree and understand that it will have faults because it's not finished. That's the whole point. But that searing kind of almost physical embarrassment is when you make a mark on the page. That's either you know what the solution is or you know that something has to be fixed because something's wrong, because the rhythm's off, the plot point doesn't make sense, something is just bad. And that if you're willing to, that searing discomfort is actually part of the process. And the actors are actively fitting into that. Michelle M. Davidson, Fee Choi, there are developments right from the start. And actors have an incredible ability to inhabit their character and know what your character will and won't do that writers are not aware of at all.
So do you think that Torch the Place is, like, at what point do you feel like, yeah, it's done, or do you not feel like that yet?
Well, you know, like, there are several points where I thought it was done. Like, when we needed to send the play off to printers, it's like, okay, that's done. That is not the play that's being performed on stage. Sorry, anyone who's going to reproduce it at a school or something. That's one milestone. And then by the time you finish what you think is the text for opening night, that's another milestone. But you've got my director, Dean Bryant. He'll be like, hey, so there's something not quite buzzing about this script, or can we punch up the joke? And that will keep happening over. It never ends, Beverly. It's never over for a playwright.
How about you, Zui? Saigon has been on for a few years now, and the text or the script, am I correct? The process was that you gathered the stories in Vietnam and France. There was a book that was written, and then the cast kind of took it on themselves to improvise the script. Would love to hear a bit of the process of how the actors worked off of the text that was presented to them, and along the same lines, how they helped the script evolve.
En fait, il y a un truc qu'il faut savoir, c'est que les histoires, enfin, le spectacle raconte des histoires recueillies, mais non seulement recueillies, parce qu'il y a aussi des histoires qu'on a recueillies, on a rematées, on a retravaillées pour que ce soit quelque chose de notre imaginaire. C'est pas complètement des histoires qu'on a trouvées dans la vie réelle, mais c'est aussi des histoires qu'on a inventées ensemble. Ça, c'est la première chose.
So, in the first place, the stories were there, but the show is beyond the stories. The stories have been taken into the imagination, into the imaginary of all the performers. So there is this evolution into imagination.
Caroline, elle a eu, des idées. Et à partir de ces idées-là, on a fait ce qu'on appelle des petites improvisation, c'est-à-dire elle propose une situation aux comédiens. Après, les comédiens vont partir réfléchir, préparer un petit spectacle, donc on appelle une petite improvisation. Après, ils vont jouer cette improvisation-là à tout le monde, donc à Caroline, à moi, à tous les autres dans l'équipe. On a travaillé ensemble pour améliorer cette improvisation-là. Des fois, on les enlève, des fois, on les garde. Voilà.
So Caroline has some ideas, and she's proposing these ideas to the cast. The cast then goes away and prepare improvisations about these ideas, present them, refine them, and then eventually these improvisations will be kept or set aside.
C'est-à-dire, on a écrit ensemble le spectacle. Bien sûr, Caroline, elle joue un rôle complètement... en tout cas, c'est elle qui décide. Mais on a écrit ensemble le spectacle. Et une fois qu'on a fini le spectacle, c'est-à-dire une fois qu'on a fini, on a fixé les scènes, c'est à ce moment-là qu'on a commencé à préparer les surtitres.
Okay, so Caroline, of course, is the decision maker, but the writing of the show has been a collective process. And eventually, once the scenes have been identified and the show has been built, then they started to actually write the subtitles then, at that stage.
Donc, c'était... surtout au mois de juin 2017, avec Caroline, j'ai vécu un moment assez changeant. C'est-à-dire, parce que du coup, c'était la fin de la création. Et ce qui est beau, c'est que chacun dans l'équipe, comme il aime trop le projet, il veut toujours rapporter quelque chose au projet. Et du coup, Caroline, elle a dû écouter la vie de tout le monde. Et voilà, pour travailler le spectacle, du coup, elle a reçu plein de... voilà, il faut rajouter ça, il faut enlever ça de la part des comédiens. Et j'ai vécu ce moment-là avec elle parce que du coup, j'ai dû traduire, on va dire, les scénarios temporaires pour travailler à l'après-midi pendant les heures de travail avec les comédiens.
At the turn of 2016-2017, which is just before the show came out, there was lots of add-ups and suggestions that kept coming from the actor. So both Caroline and Zoe had to look at all this work and process it, and eventually watching the work with the actors keep making the writing decisions even at that time.
So it sounds like the cast, choosing the right cast, is very, very important in this case because they are writing alongside you, being really quite big forces in the creative process. And the cast of Saigon is so specific. You need people who can speak French and Vietnamese at different ages, people who can speak French only, Vietnamese only. Can you talk a little bit about the process of looking for those people and the challenges?
En fait, j'ai pas eu de chance d'assister au casting pour les comédiens français, les comédiens Viet Kieu, donc les comédiens français d'origine vietnamienne, mais j'ai fait avec elle seulement des auditions au Vietnam pour recruter des comédiens vietnamiens. Et en fait, juste pour vous raconter une histoire, c'est qu'au début, on a commencé par une école privée, on va dire, qui forme des acteurs pour le cinéma. Et en fait, les étudiants de cette école-là, ils sont quand même plus aisés. Ils ont une situation assez confortable. Ils sont très très jolis, ils jouent bien. Mais finalement, Caroline, elle voulait pas travailler avec eux juste parce que elle a témoigné que pendant qu'un étudiant passe sur scène, enfin, ses amis ne le regardent pas, ne l'écoutent pas. Ils font leur truc, ils jouent au téléphone, voilà. Ils n'ont pas déjà l'esprit collectif et ils n'ont pas trop, d'après elle, le vrai cœur pour l'art. Et du coup, on a changé de destination, c'est-à-dire on est allé à l'université du cinéma et du théâtre de Ho Chi Minh Ville pour commencer les auditions.
So, for Zoe wasn't in the French auditions, which was for the Viet Kieu, that is the Vietnamese people in France, but he was in Vietnam. And it has a very interesting anecdote in that regard, that first they went to a private school where people were quite financially well off, fluent, and they were good, pretty precise, pretty actors. But Caroline noticed that when they were, one of them was auditioning, the other ones weren't looking, they were just playing on their phone, they weren't with what's happening. So that was, for her, that was not a positive point. So they ended up going to the public university of cinema in Ho Chi Minh City. And that's where she found the actors that actually had the collective attitude and the spirit that she was looking for, which is a major part of the casting. So it's not to put one school against the other, but it In the private university, there was a really good teaching and the students were at an interesting standard. But in the public school, which was, you know, Institute of Film, Cinema and Theatre in Ho Chi Minh City, there was a spirit that Caroline noticed and that was responding to what she was definitely looking for, even though the students didn't have the same means.
Mm, interesting. Let's talk about trauma and family now, Benjamin Law.
Oh, why would we talk about that with me?
And that's a topic you've really mined a lot in your work, mm-hmm. the Family Law book, Family mm-hmm. Law TV show,
yes.
Torch the Place.
I'm the Gina Reinhardt of trauma in the Chinese-Australian family.
Working that trauma dollar.
Yeah.
I've never actually asked you this, but what have you had to kind of scrutinize within your family or face within your family as you sort through all of these experiences and you know, make art out of this trauma? What have you had to confront?
Well, I think for the family law, the stuff that I was dealing with for both the book and the TV show, which was my parents' divorce and growing up gay and Asian in a very white part of Queensland, which was the last state to decriminalise homosexuality, that was far behind me. Like, by the time I was writing the family law, I was in my late 20s. My parents divorced when I was 12 years old. Like, I'd worked through that stuff, and so had my family, and that was quite, you know, not easy, but it was easier for me to make a zippy black comedy out of it. With something like Torture Place, it was slightly different because even though, you know, both my parents and my family generally have had experiences with hoarding, I think mum more to do with sentiment, dad more to do with laziness, it was a much more kind of involved research process, like a lot of reading that was done about the psychological research that had been done into compulsive hoarding, looking at friends' experiences, harvesting different stories, and then from there really creating proper fictional characters, because the family law, even though those characters aren't exactly who they are, they share my parents' names and all my siblings' names. They are inspired directly by my family. Whereas Torture Place and the play, we've got three siblings coming back for what's supposed to be their mother's 60th birthday. She thinks that it's going to be some sort of surprise birthday, but it turns out to be an intervention for her hoarding. And so that's a very kind of classic play conceit in a way. And so I needed to figure out what I was trying to say. And in a way, it became, as much as a storytelling exercise, a kind of an intellectual exercise as well. And, you know, drawing on those skills that I learned from TV writing. Okay, where are the characters? Pinning them all up onto a board until it kind of becomes like a crime scene chart, and trying to figure out what happens in a very structured way. So it wasn't really necessarily an act of catharsis as such, but almost this consolidation of all the skills that I'd brought beforehand through screenwriting. But also, as much as I'm drawing on some of my family trauma, you might say, also just drawing on a big body of research about trauma, which is not what I was doing on family law. I wasn't looking at, well, what are we trying to say about the impact of divorce on Chinese-Australian families? But this time with the play, it was really about the actual condition. What is it? Where does it come from? What am I trying to say with these characters, and how can I build drama, horror, and hopefully comedy out of it?
What is the right mix, you think, of trauma and comedy, otherwise known as traumedy? What's the ratio that works?
I don't know. It's a feeling thing rather than like a pie chart thing. Like, for me, the stuff that I've been drawn to, both on stage and on screen over the last decade, have been all those shows that aren't quite definable. I mean, dramedy is such a, that's just a gross word. It's a weird portmanteau. But the combination of drama and comedy, I think, is what life actually is closest to. You know, things that go hilariously wrong at a funeral, when weddings and birthday parties go horribly wrong. That's kind of my sweet spot with things that I want to see, with stories in which I'm interested. Those are the kinds of stories I want to tell too. And I think even with comedy, I mean, I'm all for a comedy where I just go and it's silly and I just laugh. That's fine. but I don't really feel that invested. I'll forget about it in a week. I won't remember what I even saw. But if there's a comedy that also promises to rip my heart out in the process, that's what I really, really want to see. Those are the kind of stories that I think really impact me and probably audiences the most. That's what I was trying to bring to the stage.
How about in Saigon Zui? What was the conversation around how much trauma to talk about and how to balance that out with other moods, I guess? Because this colonial story of France in Vietnam is hugely traumatic. We see so many traumatic stories and a lot of conflict and anguish on stage. What were the conversations around how to get the mix right for Saigon?
En fait, la question, enfin, déjà le mot dramatique, ça fait partie des mots que jusqu'à maintenant j'ai du mal à trouver une bonne traduction dans ma langue vietnamienne. Mais je pense que voilà, dans notre spectacle, on n'a pas tant cherché pour trouver le niveau dramatique approprié, mais c'est plutôt la question comment reproduire, enfin comment montrer, enfin c'est pas tant la question de montrer au spectateur, mais en fait dans notre idée, c'est que comme s'il y avait un quatrième mur entre la scène et les spectateurs, et que les comédiens sur scène, ils ne jouent pas, ils sont pas en train de faire un spectacle, mais ils sont en train de vivre ça sur scène.
I will precise, specify that we are talking about trauma, which is traumatism. And the answer is about drama, but it's very interesting. So in where drama is concerned, there wasn't a conversation as such. Because the play was not considered as actors playing. The play was considered like if there is a fourth wall between the acting and the audience. And the actors are actually living a situation rather than acting it. So there is no decision making about the dramatic level of the work.
Donc du coup sur en fait pendant les auditions, enfin on a fait aussi des workshops avec les comédiens vietnamiens. Caroline, elle a dit un truc, voilà. Enfin, ce qui m'a beaucoup marqué dans ma mémoire, c'est que c'est pas parce que on a de l'inquiétude, on tremble les jambes. En fait, dans son style de théâtre, on ne montre pas des signes de sentiment aux spectateurs, mais on vit ça pour les spectateurs.
So in terms, in the level of trauma, one thing that was particularly interesting because they did workshops originally with the actors is that one thing that Zoe remembers really well of the thing that Caroline was saying, she was telling that when you have anxiety, the legs do not necessarily do anxiety. So what it was the attitude, the approach was that the actors actually were not acting the anxiety. They were not showing the trauma. They were living it.
Oh, living it.
Yes. It's not a sort of acting theater. It's a sort of live theater.
Donc, sur scène, on ne cherche pas à montrer aux spectateurs qu'il y a, par exemple, une femme tellement douloureuse, mais ce qu'on montre au spectateur, c'est voilà sa situation de cette femme-là. Elle est en train de, je ne sais pas si j'ai le droit de dire, par exemple, elle a vécu, je ne sais pas, le décès de son fils, par exemple, et une femme vietnamienne qui a dû vivre ça. En fait, on reproduit ça.
For example, if we can say, they are not showing a lady in pain because her son died. They're just showing a Vietnamese lady in the process of following the death of her son.
I guess maybe to wrap up, some final thoughts from both of you. Zui, what do you hope that viewers of Saigon will take away with them in terms of an understanding of a history that they might not have thought about, or thinking about a community that is not often seen on stage or screen? What are you hoping theatergoers will take away from them after they watch Saigon?
Honnêtement, nous n'avons pas, comment dire, on s'était jamais dit, voilà, qu'est-ce que les spectateurs vont penser de cette scène, voilà, comment ils vont réagir à cette scène. Mais effectivement, c'est vrai que les histoires, c'est toujours des histoires communes. Par exemple, je pense qu'une mère vietnamienne, quand elle a vécu le décès de son fils, c'est aussi douloureux que pour une mère française ou que pour une mère, je ne sais pas, australienne, par exemple, qui doit vivre le décès de son fils, par exemple. Donc, ce qu'on cherche vraiment, c'est d'apporter Saigon, donc le spectacle, à tout le monde pour que chaque spectateur puisse se retrouver quelque part dans le spectacle.
So there wasn't a deliberate intention about the impact of the show. What they are hoping and they are thinking is that those stories actually are universal. The story of a mother who lost her son, whether she is Vietnamese or French or Australian, can be similar. So the aim of the show is really for people to find their connections and to take how it resonates, the show, the stories, how they resonate with their own self, each individual. So it can be assumed that every Australian or every French or most of them have been to a restaurant, a Vietnamese restaurant, that they have met Vietnamese people, that they have seen a Vietnamese lady cooking. Nevertheless, beyond this knowledge, you cannot assume either that they will be able to understand or feel what this person has exactly lived. So on one hand, the story has a certain level of privacy, of personality, but at the same time, they're universal to all people who have been displaced, who have refugees, or who have been in exile.
How about you, Ben? What do you hope that audiences at Torch the Place will take away with them?
That they be emotionally traumatized. No, one of the things that I really wanted to do with the play was to look at the condition of compulsive hoarding properly and with humanity. It's a condition that is so represented ostensibly in popular culture, you know, reality TV shows, you know, Oprah specials, even, you know, mild cases in Marie Kondo's show, sensational newspaper reports about the hoarder down the road, blah, blah, blah. I think some of those shows do it quite well, but a lot of them take this, what is a real mental disorder and illness, and really turn it kind of into a form of entertainment. And I acknowledge that a play is a form of entertainment as well, but what we really wanted to do was to really capture the complexities of something properly, and also the people who are affected by it beyond the actual person who might be hoarding themselves. You know, you wouldn't make a reality TV show about chronic anxiety and depression. But for some reason, hoarding, because the physical manifestation of it is so obvious and so visible and so shameful, a lot of people look at that and think, well, that's the horror. And when you look at the research, what it shows is that condition always doesn't come from a place of deprivation or privation or from a sense that you don't have anything when you were growing up. It always comes from a place of trauma. And unless we actually honor that, we're not actually going to have a proper understanding of what this condition is and what it does to the people who love people who live with this disorder as well. So I want to invest a sense of humanity, and given that it's such a common condition relatively, statistically it's been estimated that over 1 million Australians have some form of compulsive hoarding disorder, I want people to kind of feel seen as well, that it's nothing to be ashamed of to have this, but to also start a conversation about what it actually is and where you can progress from there.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us on the Wheeler Center podcast. Benjamin Law, thank you. Nguyen Duc Duy, thank you very much from the Saigon production. And Ellen Embling for your interpretation.
Thank you, Beverly.
Thank you very much, Beverly. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.